Hello and welcome. I'm Alexander.
I am Haney.
And I'm Simon.
We are Native in Tech, covering the latest from the IT industry with a specific focus on Microsoft and how to get actual value from technology. This is episode 310, the first of two special episodes on Microsoft Build. You will be able to find this and our previous episodes on nativeintech.com, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and on most podcasting platforms. And some of you might have noticed that there's a bit of a gap between 308 and 310. Where did 309 go? Well, it was an audio-only recording that we did in Stockholm, so we didn't think it made any sense to put on YouTube. There's only so much fun you can have looking at the Native in Tech logo for 30 minutes. So it's on audio where you usually find the audio stuff, like Spotify, for instance. Mm-hmm. But we're back now.
Yep.
And we're going to start with looking back on 308, because let's just say that 308 didn't age well.
or it did.
It aged really well.
Or it did. Yeah. I don't even know where to start. Simon, do you want to take this?
I'm relatively positive to what we're going to talk about. But hey, let's go for it. As you might know, the US government, I assume, or Donald Trump in person.
Oh, I've heard about it, yes.
Yeah. So they have put sanctions on the ICC, the International Crime Court. Is that the
criminal court? No, or yeah. the International Court of Justice.
It doesn't make sense that it's ICC then.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague.
Yeah, thank you.
It makes sense.
Yeah. And as a follow-up on that, Microsoft and other U.S. companies ceased to deliver services to this sanctioned organization. Therefore, leaving them without things like email, since that's hosted in Exchange Online. And this is just to get the context, this is in response to the arrest warrants against Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant in Israel. And then Trump put these sanctions to the ICC. And this is exactly what we talked about, sort of, in 308. So what's your thoughts on this? Is this just the first step of other things where Microsoft will have to be forced to cut services? Or is this something that's already been happening, but in the light and the context that we have today, it looks a bit odd?
So I've done some digging, and I cannot find a clear source on which way to lean on this, because mm-hmm. there are people that says that you need, as an organization, as a company, in this case Microsoft, you have to cut ties with whatever entity that the government puts on a sanction list. And you don't have a choice, and that would be the end of that conversation. Others say, well, you don't really need to, but it does come with some drawbacks if you don't. And I don't think that really matters. What matters is that now a government, in this case the United States government, can essentially dictate what services are rendered to other foreign organizations. This is not new, but it's very new to issue sanctions based on the most bananas opinions. And I think that is that's the crux, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts, Haney?
Completely agree with the former. I think we now also pay more attention that we just talked about it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it brings it to a different light due to the previous blogs that we covered in the previous episode. So it, of course, kind of gets highlighted more. And yeah, it makes you think. That's where I'm still at. I'm still like, oh, I need to think about this.
But going back to what Microsoft said, if there are any issues with Europe, we're going to stand by Europe. Well, how? What weapons do they have, and would they bring them out?
That is a good question.
Yeah, and this is where I personally think that we need to separate what's going on, and also go back to the point we made in 308 that this hasn't really changed anything. It's a lot of marketing. Because look at what's happened. This is basically the same thing that happened to Russia. US put sanctions on Russia and Microsoft ceased to deliver services to Russia and no one cared. For good reasons. This is the same thing. What makes it challenging is that the entire sanctioning of the court is just ridiculous. So Microsoft is following the law.
Mm. Yeah.
And are doing the same thing as they would for any other sanction that the US government put on anything. I think it's a huge difference between that and if the US administration were to say, hey, we will put enormous tariffs on US cloud services if you don't do this. That's a place where Microsoft could say, hey, yes, they are doing this, but we are then lowering our costs, just as an example, to protect Europe or figuring out other ways to deliver it. And again, I might be biased, I might be naive, but I do think it's a very important difference from a Microsoft point of view in following relatively straight laws and where we care, because this is an organization we care about, and it's one of the most infected political situations globally currently. That's why we care. And that's why it also it's put into this context.
So I don't agree with that, because I think the morality of the whole question is much, much simpler in this specific instance. And I absolutely think it is beyond reproachful to sanction a court.
Yeah, like, yeah, of course.
Dude, don't. So that's where the breach of humanity is really in this mm-hmm. this conversation. But so yes, I don't agree in details, but I think I agree in principle.
Yeah.
So we're back to the old rules don't apply, and act accordingly.
Yeah.
Which sort of kind of brings us to politicization.
I think that's a word.
Almost.
That is a really hard word.
Might be the first time ever that you have struggled with an English word.
When something is politicized, that I can pronounce, but politicized. Yeah, let's go with politicized. There are political implications of that we see in what has usually been a very apolitical situation. Mm-hmm. Microsoft Build.
Yeah.
Really? What happened?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure that out because this... we have been to hundreds of conferences. And we, of course, have had, to some extent, political discussions during the conferences. In the hallways, with friends, with people. But for some reason, Build this year seems to have become... like one of the first technical conferences I've heard about where you actually have protesters on the streets. And from what I know, this has nothing to do with the sanctions against the ICC. This was before.
True.
A lot of demonstrations to support Palestine and put pressure on Israel for the war in Gaza, as an example. We will get to other non-technical headlines that have... came out from Build. But I'm very surprised to see this, and I wonder what caused it, because yes, everyone is watching Build, but it's a relatively small conference.
For sure. Mm. No, I it surprises me to no end. Why now and why build?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of all the conferences, because it's not like you have the really higher ups decision makers at build. Sorry. Yeah. We're all nerds. Hi. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah. But of course, we had some interesting things happen in the keynotes. I mean, bringing on Elon Musk.
That, I would love to speak to the marketing person who thought that was a good idea.
Yeah.
I don't have any comments. Yeah. And I would love to know who uses Grok and why. Or I guess they want to have all the AI models on Azure. But would they really need to have all AI models on Azure?
And it's one thing to...
How much business are they losing?
And it's one thing to have the model, and then, another thing to have somebody like in the keynote on such.
Yep, that is cringeworthy.
Yeah. So that's another thing. I also just noticed in the demonstration, the picture from one of the demonstrations from Build, that one person have a sign saying no Google or Amazon tech for US-Israeli war.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm questioning why bring that to a Microsoft event.
Huh.
I have so many questions.
I don't think we can answer them.
No, we'll soon get to the actual content of this. But we could talk about this. We have touched on it in different episodes, like how much political things should you bring into technology? Should you be one of these persons that say, hey, I only work with technology, therefore I don't care what happens around it? Or should you use technology to make an impact somehow?
True.
One other quick thing I would like to mention is the fact that Microsoft's AI security chief really needs to work on her skills in terms of presentations. Because apparently during her session at Build, she revealed some relatively sensitive information from a Teams chat that she still had up on her screen.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and that feels like, shouldn't you be experienced enough to know that? Like, even I close everything down when I do any tiny presentation.
Yep.
For things like Build or major conferences, I reboot my machine and only open whatever I need and shuts everything down, exactly as I do when we record this podcast.
Mute notifications. Yep.
So this podcast is this podcast is about as important as Build, is what you're saying.
More important.
Yeah, and we are more professional.
Yeah, well, yeah, clearly.
So a lot of headlines that weren't technology focused from Build, a lot of attention for non-technical things. I think we can catch up on a lot of these topics again at the later stage. But most of our listeners and now viewers aren't here to hear us talk about and make non-complete arguments about politics. What's happened during Build?
Let's ask AI.
Have you done it?
No, I have not, but I'm reading our comments. Yes. What was happening on the AI side of things? Because AI Foundry, AI everything, tell me.
Yeah, I don't think there were a few things that weren't AI, but most of the announcements were around AI. So let's start with what I think let's start with M365 Copilot. And just so we are done with copiloting, and then we'll go into the other basic stuff. I think the buzzword that I've figured out from this event is this multi-agent orchestration, integrations, agents and agents and agents, more agents than in any good Matrix movie, and also how to orchestrate them. So a lot of the announcements and we'll start with M365 Copilot, is about how to optimize each of your AI agents for a purpose and then use multiple of these agents to do a bigger task.
So you're actually Kubernetesing your AI agents.
Oh,
that's one way to think about it.
Huh.
Did
not think of that reference.
I guess so. Well done. So some of the announcements were that we are getting the Copilot Wave 2 release. That was not, like, it was not nothing new, really. We can now fine-tune our agents to business needs. I don't really see how that is something new either. So the main thing that is new, as I see it, is this multi-agent orchestration, where you can make these agents aware of each other and use the AI Foundry, which we'll get back to for Windows, to ensure that you have all of your different models, all of your different agents, they are working together to be or complete a specific or a more complex task. So one of the things they have as an example is if you schedule a meeting, you might have one agent that's really good at finding the perfect conference room and another agent that goes out and looks at everyone's calendars to try to figure out what you should and shouldn't do. And all of these agents gather their results into one, the main agent that you ask the question, and that agent delivers it. And these sub-agents, I guess there's probably a better word for it, can also ask questions back through the main agent. So if they need more information, okay, you're booking a meeting, what do you need in the conference room? That question is surfaced back to me as the prompter, and the answer is then given back to you through the main agent to the sub-agent.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
And we'll talk more about the identities of these agents in the next episode, because that's, let's do a cliffhanger here, that's probably the coolest of announcements that I've found during Build. But Microsoft have also made a couple of investments into Windows. Or, first and foremost, is this the most efficient way, you think, to use AI?
You referencing the Windows part or the multi-agent part?
No, sorry. I was just getting ahead of myself. So the multi-agent orchestration, is it a way for Microsoft to earn more money, or is it really the most efficient way to do it?
It depends.
Alexander looks it.
Sorry, I had to.
Damn it. You're not at
I
work.
Know, but truly it does depend. Like if you're I think the example is a little, you know, unfortunate, because I think it gets people thinking in terms of like little nitty-gritty things that the agents do. Mm-hmm. But I do think it also highlights still an important point that the agents are often very specialized to answering something specific very well. And, you know, that's mm-hmm. why we're moving towards this multi-agent pattern, because of that. Kind of that limitation. I don't know if it's a limitation, but, you know, that aspect. Mm-hmm. So if you can truly find a use case where you need these different mm-hmm. agents, I think it can be a very powerful way to do it. But then if you're just like, oh, I could be doing these tasks by calling an API or, you know, something like that. Of course, the agent can call an API as well. That's not like they're not.
Yeah.
I have only Finnish coming to my mind today. What is happening? But
so what I'm thinking is, what I'm thinking is take booking a flight.
Yeah.
For instance, that is a very simple proposition to state. The problem statement is simple. Book me a flight between Stockholm and Guadeloupe. Just throwing it out there. That's easy. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you start looking at constraints, mm-hmm. then it becomes much more difficult. And then it pretty much is going to expose where is the cutoff between complexity and capability of the hyper-specialized agent. Where do you bump up against the specialization being a limiting factor for the agent? I don't know. As Haney said, I'm sure there's going to be use cases, but they do feel very convoluted, and it feels like we have a solution, but we are looking for a proper problem, and we have still to find a problem that the solution really fits. That's my opinion on most of the whole talk to your data or ask your data questions crap.
I'm gonna talk more about that.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Please. I'm gonna throw a couple of other things under the bus while I'm at it. So
yeah. So I will just summarize two other points that goes into this very quickly. They are much broader, so we'll probably get back to them. We have the Windows AI Foundry, which is a combination of various techniques, APIs, models, a way to build agents and integrations to Windows that runs on Windows on various kinds of silicon and make that very simple for any developer to build local AI that leverages NPU, CPU, GPU in a very efficient way on the Windows operating system, especially for Copilot. But if you then want to have multiple agents running locally or anywhere else, Microsoft is also integrating the Model Concept Protocol developed by Anthropic, which is sort of kind of a integration engine. So where you have one common integration layer where different models, different AI models can exchange data in between themselves. And I think that's the really strong point of multi-agent orchestration. When you can have specialized, not just agents, but specialized models trained on specialized data to do a specific task in your context, then you need something that goes beyond Copilot, because Copilot isn't the best AI engine for any particular thing. You can have very many other different models, including the one by the person who founded Tesla, if you want to do that for any reason. So we'll probably get back to it, but there are tons of more exciting news. And I look forward to see what Alexander will bash next.
Oh, yeah. I try, right? So build has turned into, just like every other Microsoft event, has really turned into what's new in Fabric.
Surprise.
I mean, it's clear that if you want to have a job in Microsoft, you either need to do Copilot or you need to do Fabric.
Or Windows 365.
Maybe. Don't bet on it. No, so there was a ton of new things coming out for Fabric. And this is hot on the heels of FabCon in Vegas. So it's just been a couple of weeks, but still they pump out a lot of new features. And I want to mention just a couple of them. Before we run out of time for this episode, I have some more for the next episode. But Fabric CLI, the thing that nobody asked for and everybody love. It's a command line interface. We are literally stepping back like 30 years in time to get a command line interface where you can do things to your Fabric environment. It's absolutely bananas, and I love it. It's one of these things that nobody really asked for, because nobody in their right mind would build a CLI for this. But hey, it does exactly what I wanted to do for quick things that I wouldn't use it for automation. You can absolutely use it for as a basis for automation, but I'd rather probably use the REST APIs for stuff. If I can automate it in PowerShell, I might as well just run REST APIs. But here, if I want to go in and just dump all the structures for all the artifacts in a workspace, I can do so. I just use cd, change directory in there, and run one command. Boom, done. Easy. So it's one of these universal toolkits that, again, nobody asked for and nobody had an idea what was coming. And it just makes sense. It's a huge simplifier. If only the rest of the technical debt could be handled as swiftly. Let's put it that way. So that's a big thing. There were a couple of smaller things. You could probably call these partly quality of life updates, but still. So shortcut transformations. Shortcuts are, again, a step back 30 years to a symbolic link. Instead of copying data, you have a link, say, for instance, between Dataverse and Fabric. So you can query a file in one lake in Fabric, but in essence, it actually lives somewhere else or it's copied into the one lake. So you don't necessarily always have the data physically there. The thing is, it's just the shortcut. It can't do squat. It contains the exact same information on both sides. That's the point. Mm-hmm. But at the MVP summit, we got to see a couple of things. And one of these things was this shortcut transformation. So now you can use the shortcut to do some computationally intensive tasks on the data as it streams by. And this opens up both a can of worms. Like, there are so many questions that and so many issues that you can run into. But for smaller things, I think it could be a really interesting way of getting data in that doesn't really require you to do a lot of hands-on work.
But you're not changing anything at the source, right?
Nope.
You're basically taking whatever it is, streaming it through something and changing it once it gets into your workspace.
Yes.
Yep.
Exactly that. So what's the difference between that and a pipeline, for instance? Well, now you just have one new tool.
That's always fun.
And for sure. And while we're at it, we might as well talk about materialized views. A view in a database is essentially a select statement that you cache. So whenever you query the view, because if the view will behave like a table, a virtual table, it's going to fire off the query that is the view. But it's already cached the instructions for the view, so it's going to be faster than running the query just as is. A materialized view is persisted. So it's essentially a copy of the result that gets refreshed whenever something changes on the source side. So this means that you can essentially have the cake and eat it. You can have a very, very fast cached copy of your data source, but you will need to figure out how do I make sure that it's updated. That's what a materialized view is. We now have those in preview for lake houses in Spark. So this is a really interesting mechanism that supposedly, I haven't tried it yet, so I really can't say if it works, but supposedly it's a declarative way of telling Spark, do this. I don't care how, make it happen. So I can define a query to look at a table, and I say, give me this table and aggregate it like this, and whenever something changes underneath, it will refresh the materialized view. Really interesting, opens up a lot of interesting use cases that we didn't have before. It was a bit of a pain in the posterior to do a lot of these things. So very excited about this. I was part of helping draft the original design of it. And they did cool things with it. So let's say that.
I'm excited about this.
Yeah. And the last thing, and then I'm pretty sure that we are out of time for this episode.
I haven't even started.
Some stuff needs to be, I know. Some more things need to be bumped to the next one. But SPN support for the Livy API. It's one of these things that, okay, that's a bundle of words. What does it mean? So the Livy API is the API that essentially schedules Spark tasks. And with SPN support means that I can now have a SPN. What does SPN mean?
Service principal.
Thank you. Yeah. So it's a virtual account, essentially, an entry account, can now schedule and run Spark jobs,
yeah.
Which means that stuff like DBT, for yeah. instance, can now be very efficiently automated and kick off these Spark jobs. So it opens up more opportunities, more secure opportunities, I should say, for running Spark, because there are some issues with security context in Fabric. Let's not dive into that because I will be angry.
Yes, and I will have no time to talk about Fabric data agents if you do that.
No, so I'll be quiet now. You don't have any time,
yes,
but do it
so
anyways.
I am going to pick some of the items on my side since you two ate up all my time today.
Sorry.
But the Fabric-related item that I was going to bring up is the Fabric data agents that were announced. And what Fabric data agents try to help you to do is so that you are able to create a data agent, interact with your data through a large language model, essentially, so that you are able to write your question in natural language. Currently, it says in English. And it will respond to you based on your data in your Fabric environment, in your OneLake, for example. So essentially, you pose your question, then it uses OpenAI APIs behind the scenes, and then it accesses the data source schemas, for example, and uses, of course, the user's kind of access boundary to do that, so you're not able to accidentally fetch something that you are not supposed to see. And then it evaluates that question against the data that is in your Fabric environment. This includes Lakehouse and Warehouse, semantic models, and KQL databases at this point. And then you will get back your results based off of those. And it might actually behind the scenes take your question and turn that into a SQL statement that it queries against the data, or KQL or DAX, depending on kind of the data source it is actually leveraging behind the scenes. So make sure, if you want to test this out, it's in preview. You need some tenant settings to be enabled. There's no limitation on the Fabric capacity, but make sure you realize this will eat up your Fabric capacity as well. So test in a controlled manner.
Just a quick question for me that I have a hard time understanding data. Are these questions, let's see if I can put it this the right way. Are these questions about your data or how you as an IT administrator or data analyst would like to do things with the data? Or could you use this as a user asking the Fabric agent to actually give you something value, some value of
yes.
the data?
So this is targeted towards more the non-technical user that needs to be able mm-hmm. to fetch some insights based off of your data. So that is what it's targeted at. So essentially, you have this capability to have a conversation with your data.
I have so many questions that we'll leave for another time about this.
But this is surprisingly potentially useful, because you're combining the language understanding mm-hmm. and see my enormous air quotes of an LLM, mm-hmm. but you also make it hyper specialized on your specific mm-hmm. data, which means that if you have a good data model, if it
exactly.
is well designed, then you can get reasonably smart answers out of this specific kind of AI application. Now, does that mean that most normal people would like to have a conversation with their data?
Maybe.
I am not entirely sure.
But that's exactly the selling point of all the other agents. It's just different kinds of data. So my question is, why would you use the Fabric agent and not the other agents?
I'm not sure if you can expose the same data to those agents.
No, I'm not certain. But like...
Well,
I think we need to follow up on this.
Yeah. Okay, I will just keep quiet. Because
No.
I wanted to highlight maybe two other items that related to the ones that already were mentioned today. Very shortly, do not look too concerned. In terms of Simon talking about this Windows, what was it called? Windows AI Foundry? Was that correct? Yeah. Perfect. So actually one part of this is the Foundry Local that they announced at Build. And that is what then is also helping power, of course, Windows AI Foundry. But the Foundry Local is something that is a local AI runtime that you could run on Windows or on Mac OS, either one. So it's not just limited to Windows. And it essentially allows you to build an AI app then locally on your machine. And you're able to build cross-platform AI apps if you wish to using local Foundry Local. So I find this more interesting than the Windows AI Foundry stuff. Just to point that out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But
all right, we are over time, like we always are. I'm starting to think that maybe we should aim for 15 minutes.
Yes.
Maybe we'll clock in at 30, but be that as it may. Thank you so much for watching. I usually say thank you so much for listening, but now you might be listening or you might be watching or you might do both at the same time, because I have it in good authority that you can actually look at moving video and have audio at the same time. Yes, I'm surprised as you are. Anyways, we'll be back in a week. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Native in Tech. Native in Tech is a weekly technology podcast hosted by Alexander Arvidsson, Simon Binder, and Heini Ilmarinen. If you have any feedback, questions, or would like to be part of an episode, please reach out to us on social media or via email at podcast@nativetech.com.